Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is nonfiction writer and poet Allison Hawthorne Deming, professor in creative writing at the University of Arizona. She lives in Tucson, Arizona, and on Grand Manan Island in New Brunswick, Canada. And we're talking about her poetry collection, Stairway to Heaven. Allison, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here, Mark.
Now, it's for me, you're a fascinating character because you write nonfiction prose.
Yeah.
And then you write poetry. And I mean this sincerely. Those seem to me to be very separate frames of creative minds. although I'll say on your book, the last one that we just did about the sardine dress.
Yeah.
I thought that was very poetic. I thought the whole layout, the flow of it and everything was very poetic. Talk to me about, were you a writer first or a poetry writer first?
Well, I started out as a poet. I mean, I you know, like a lot of people, I started out just writing journals because I was so confused about everything in life, and the journal was a place to maybe I could sort some stuff out. And
how did that work out for you, Allison?
I'm still confused about life. I'm still working in notebooks to figure it out. So
I didn't mean to be such a wise guy, but I think that you're right. No. I think you're absolutely right. We hope that there's going to be something that comes out of this.
Yeah.
And it doesn't.
Well, there's clarity. And then, you know, it's like, I always love the metaphor of the circle of knowledge. The larger the circle of knowledge, the larger the perimeter of ignorance. So, you know, how that works.
Wow.
But no, I started out writing poetry. And, I wrote very privately for a long time. And I just, in the 60s, everybody was reading poetry. And it was very involved in political activism, too, at the time, anti-war, anti-nuclear weaponry, et cetera. And I got taken up in it and fell in love with poetry, and particularly contemporary poetry. But there were subjects I wanted to write about that had a lot of content. Like, I've always been astonished and just profoundly saddened at the diminishment of the natural world, and it just seemed like poetry wasn't enough to get at how can this relationship between human beings and the planet and their cultures be so messed up, you know? So I turned to prose because there's, you know, you can deal with content better, I think, in prose.
Well, and again, in total respect to you as a poet, and I love your poetry, are you saying that a prose book has more impact than a poetry book?
As far as impact, I don't know. It may, only because prose has a larger readership and poetry has a very small audience. Poetry can have an enormous impact over a long period of time. You know, you think of people like Walt Whitman or think about Gary Snyder. Think about his impact in terms of writing about the natural world. You know, I think it's been pretty important and pretty profound.
Right, right.
But, you know, there are small audiences for poetry, and in the United States, anyway. I don't complain about that. It's fine with me.
You're not that kind of a person anyways. You're not a complainer.
Well, believe me, I can earn my whining rights when I need to. But I work hard to try to find to lean towards the optimistic side of life, because otherwise, you know, it's hard to get out of bed in the morning. So,
well, you know, you're talking about, I think I'm a little bit older than you. But you were talking about poetry back in the 60s and the early 70s. It seemed that poetry was everywhere at that point.
Yeah, it was.
What happened? For my money, it seems like poetry all of a sudden got shunted aside a lot in, say, late 80s, 90s, and into this century. Is that my perception, or is that your perception too?
I don't think so, but I think it fractured into lots of little pods and cults and
that's
clubs.
That's right. Okay.
And I think that's the difference. Whereas in the 60s, it was, you know, it was emerging into this great explosion of both, you know, freedom in forms and concern for where the culture was going and where it was headed. And it all seemed to come together at that time. But we've had, you know, many schools and disciplines. You know, we had the language poetry movement, which, you know, had its own kind of radicality, but it turned a lot of audiences away because nobody could understand it. You know, the ideas were interesting, but it's like, you know, that had a very small audience for poetry. And we've had identity politics, which has been great and really important, and it's brought audiences for LGBTQ writers. You know, we've certainly had, you know, a great emergence of writing poetry from African-American poets and Native American poets. So we have all these movements going on. They don't kind of coalesce into one movement, but I particularly think we're in a really dynamic time for poetry and that there's a lot going on, that the work is exciting and interesting, and maybe it'll coalesce around some kind of sense of the value and importance of poetry. But if it stays in various small audience groups, you know, that might be all right. I think going for a mass audience is often a dangerous enterprise. when we think about the word populist and where it's led us to politically in recent years, I don't aspire to be a populist.
One of the things I'm concerned about, and I mean, we'll talk specifically about your poetry in a bit, but I've always wondered, are we not teaching poetry in like sort of high school, grade school, the way we used to? I mean, I grew up and I had to learn, and I also had to read a lot of the major poets.
Yeah.
I just don't think that's going on anymore.
Yeah, I did too. You know, we had to memorize poems.
Right. I remember reciting. I can still recite poems from that time period.
I love it. I fell in love with poetry because I was made to read it as a child and as an adolescent. And it's been in many school curriculums, it's been eliminated. The arts have suffered terribly under this, testing regime.
Yeah.
It is, I know, in some criteria for things that students will be tested for, certainly poetry, literary arts, and other arts are not included any longer, as if they're kind of peripheral entertainments rather than, you know, the central voice of what people struggle with in the human condition in their given time. So, you know, that's sad. I mean, the other thing is that people are scared of poetry. The way they were taught in many cases was, poetry is like really complicated and you just don't get the hidden meaning. It's not like you don't get the hidden meaning. Poetry is strange and it brings the unconscious into play with the conscious mind. And, you know, it's like if you have a dream, you're not upset if everything isn't crystal clear. You just think about it a little longer, you know, and see if it begins to make sense. And then I think
that's a really good way to phrase it. I think that's a great way to phrase it.
Way to think about poetry, you know. Don't be freaked out like there's one hidden meaning. There isn't, you know.
Yeah, there's not a code book that you can buy that'll decode.
Exactly. right. You get a special ring and you will get all the poems.
That would be wicked excellent if that was
true.
That'd
be cool. Let's have a poetry ring. But, you know, there's also, I mean, poets, you know, I fall in love with language. I love the music of language. I love weird new words. I love words that come in from science. I love, you know, so, you know, whether I'm writing prose or poetry, I'm always like riding on the music of the language and taking pleasure in it. Even if it's a very dark poem, there's the pleasure of language itself, which moves you along and I think can move the reader. So
I know for me, when I'm reading poetry, a certain word that I didn't expect that the poet would use crops up, and it's like there's a real pleasure in that. I want to talk about you personally as a creative person.
Yeah.
Is there a totally different mindset that you're going through when you're composing poetry and when you're writing a prose piece? And even physically, like when you're writing for, like, say, creating a book, are your rhythms different? Are you sitting down and how are you? Are they different at all? Or are they the same thing? Like you can sit down and make yourself write a poem.
Yeah, I can sit down and make myself write a poem. I mean, it might not be a very good poem, but I can do it. And you know, there's the whole, somebody told me when I was a young poet coming up, I hated hearing this, but I think it's true. More poets fail from lack of discipline than lack of talent. You know, if you just wait for inspiration, you're not going to write very much. If you sit down at the desk and you write something, good or bad, you've written something. You can make it better. You can throw it away. You can write something else. But it's actually a discipline and a practice, you know, to keep going. And I don't know if it's poems are a little bit more mysterious in the way they come into being. You know, you can have some images that come back to mind. You can have a dream or read something that just piques your interest and you think there's something that captures my mind here. There's some tension or contradiction that interests me. I think I'll make some notes and see if those notes lead to a poem.
Do you write poetry and then let it sit for a while and then go back to it and then throw out a lot of it?
Yeah, I throw out a lot. But I often write rough drafts or poems by hand, and then once I put them in the computer, I'll start working on revisions, and I do quite a lot of revising. And sometimes I work when I'm out in the field, you know, particularly in this book, Stairway to Heaven, I spent a week in Death Valley with an astronomer, Stephen Strom, who was taking photographs, and I was writing poems. So I was taking notes in the field as I was observing, and did the same thing when I went to the biosphere here in Tucson.
Well, let's talk about biosphere, because there's a series. It's a long poem with several chapters, and it's like a story in and of itself. Like you could have published that just as a separate book. It's called Biosphere 2, Theory of Art. So what inspired or caused you to write that?
Well, I was invited to, I had been out there many times. The Biosphere 2 is this amazing facility that has a checkered history because the first iteration of its life was about trying to prepare people to live in conditions on other worlds. And it was run in a very bizarre and theatrical way and became very sensationalistic. And they did an experiment of sealing these people in to see if they could survive without outside input of food and air. And, well, they ended up cheating in order to survive. And it was considered pretty disreputable. But ultimately, over its long history, Biosphere 2 now is run by the University of Arizona, where I teach, and it's actually an incredibly interesting research site for climate change, where under controlled circumstances, they can do experiments to figure out, well, what happens if you deprive a rainforest of rain? They can do small-scale experiments so that when they actually go out in the rainforest, they're really prepared. And so I was invited to go out with another group of poets see what we would make of it if we spent a few days out there and wrote poems. So I wrote that series of poems, and I just felt so much kinship between science and art when I was out there. It's like this sci-fi construction in a movie. It's a magnificent structure with five different habitat types, and Yeah, it's a pretty amazing place. So I wrote this series that you mentioned called Biosphere 2, Theory of Art.
When you write a series like that, which is interesting when you come across it within a collection, it really stands out. Do you know when it's over? In other words, you're writing a section. Is it natural? Does it come to a natural conclusion, or do you have to force yourself to end it?
Well, in this case, I wrote a poem for each of the habitats. And I had two poems for the lung, which was the breathing device that the building had, this huge diaphragm that would rise and flow in the course of the day with the heat of the day that helped to control the oxygen and, you know, the atmosphere within the biosphere. So that one was determined by the space itself. But it, I could keep going. I mean, I love sequences. I wrote a book called The Monarchs, which was a 60-poem sequence because
wow.
I just didn't want to stop. I just, you know. There's a lot of anxiety. Where does a poem end? Where does a poem start? I don't know. I'm not writing sonnets, so it's not like 14 lines and you're done, you know. And so a sequence says, okay, it's okay. You know, have a short break here and then keep the sequence going with the next piece that's all part of the same. And it's really, it's a pleasurable way to write for me.
Is there a section of Biosphere 2 that I could ask you to read for the benefit of the audience?
Sure. How about if I read you the one called Human Habitat?
Okay.
One of the places that you could visit in there, not just the biological zones, like there was an ocean zone and a desert zone and a rainforest zone, but you could go to the habitat where the original crew of Biospherians stayed when they were locked in that first experiment. And their little library was there, the actual books that some of the people had been reading when they were in lockdown. So this poem takes place in that human habitat. And it refers to that experiment that they lived through. Human habitat. Some did not want to alter the design when the failure message said massive problem with oxygen. Some wanted to live full tilt with risk. By then, we were too weak for daily chores, feeding chickens, hoeing yams, calibrating pH this and N2 that, felt like climbing Everest. We didn't expect the honeybees to die. Glass blocked the long wave light that guides them. Farm soil too rich in microbes, concrete too fresh, ate the oxygen. We had pressure problems, recalibrating the sniffer. Bone tired, I read Aristotle by waning light. Being is either actual or potential. The actual is prior to substance. Man prior to boy, human prior to seed, Hermes prior to chisel hitting wood. I leafed through Turner's England, left the book open at Stonehenge. A shepherd struck by lightning lies dead, dog howling several sheep down. The painter gave gigantic proportion to sulfurous, god-rimmed clouds, lightning slashing indigo sky, while close at hand lie fallen stones. Dead religion. Pages dusty, brown leaf shards gathering in the gutter. Yet I cannot turn the page, wondering what I am and when in the story of life is my life taking place. Now what? No shepherd, no cathedral. How is it then that I love, that I read love in pages that lie open before me?
That's an amazing piece right there. But it's part of a much larger whole, and people need to get this book and read the whole epic poem. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is nonfiction writer and poet Allison Hawthorne Deming, professor in creative writing at the University of Arizona. She lives in Tucson, Arizona, and on Grand Manan Island in New Brunswick, Canada. And we're talking about her poetry collection, Stairway to Heaven. Allison, reading this collection as a whole, there are poems that seem to be the vacillate between the desert and the New England coast or the Northeast coast.
Mm-hmm.
Is that ping-pongs back and forth?
Yeah. Well, that's me. These two landscapes have been very profound for me. I've been living in the desert here for almost 32 years, but I'm a 10th generation New Englander and still spend summers off the coast of eastern Canada. So landscapes speak really profoundly to me. They always have since I was a child, growing up in the woods in Connecticut. And I always find inspiration in the land. And, you know, that last poem mentions Turner, who was the 19th century landscape painter in England. And he was kind of credited by John Ruskin as being a guy who lifted landscape painting up so that it equaled portrait painting, where, you know, painting's been the history of great people who could pay you to write to paint a portrait. But Turner makes that move of raising the landscape, and you know, he'll show cathedrals in ruins, but the landscape is transcendent, magnificent, you know. And I think that I'm a little bit like Turner in the 21st century, even though our experience of ruin spills into the natural world because of all that's going on with climate change and species extinction. But I find these two places, both New England and Eastern Canada and the desert, really instructive to me in many ways.
Do you miss the ocean when you're in the desert?
I miss the ocean. I think that, you know, as some people have theorized, that we form deep relationships with the landscape of our childhood. I miss the ocean all the time. I miss the woods of the Northeast. That's the landscape I grew up in. I've come to love the desert, but it's a much more forbidding habitat.
It's funny. You have a wonderful poem, Questions for Saguaro.
yeah,
I love that. That's a great poem too. But it's amazing to read your Northeast poems and your desert poems as sort of this sort of pendulum that goes back and forth. Death, though, is a theme in a number of your poems, and
yeah.
Death of your mother and your brother.
Yeah.
Was writing poetry a way for you to come to terms with their passing?
Very much so. Very much so. You know, grief can really level you, and they both died in the same year.
Yeah.
My mother at 102, so it was, you know, okay. But my brother in his 60s and after a hard life, so and a heart disease. So, yeah, poetry was one of the ways, of pulling myself out of the hole of grief and the way it kind of stops you from wanting to engage with anything. You know, one of the challenges in that kind of loss is how can I continue to be in love with life, you know,
right,
when this
right.
is what happens. And I think in a lot of ways that's what the book is about, is how do I keep being in love with life when I have to accept these terrible losses and the suffering of people I love and where we're all headed. So, yeah, it does have... that is the central drift of the book, I would say.
Those are powerful poems, too. I want to ask you before we run out of time, would you be willing to read one more poem from the collection?
I'd be happy to.
I'd be happy to listen to it.
It's always hard to pick one.
I know.
Well, let's stick with the landscape,
okay.
But I'd like to read one from the Death Valley sequence.
That's another whole long series.
Yeah. It's a whole long series, and I did a lot of research looking at the whole geology and evolution in the plant life, et cetera, in Death Valley, which is a kind of place that is the most extreme for anything to live in because of its heat and aridity. But it became a kind of closing metaphor, if you will, for the book, because the whole book, of course, is a passage through Death Valley. And then there is this message that I think contained in this poem, which is perhaps the moral of the story. This is poem number 5 in the sequence. Called Death Valley Sequence. Hoodoo, Badland, Turtleback. A place this stark needs its own vocabulary. Unverdant land, testing life for extremes that lie ahead as deserts spread and water goes and sky has nothing good to say about the future. Hard to stay in the moment when time has gouged and layered its story out so frankly. Siltstone, sandstone, mudstone, like neighbors that can't stop talking about the past and all they've been through. If only I could get the sequence of events right. What? It seems I'd know a continuity that could stand up to death. Mountain Lynx taking snow and turning it into wildflowers.
That's a beautiful poem.
Thanks, Mark.
I really love that. And I love hearing you read it because it's a totally different voice as opposed to the one in my head.
Well, it is.
It's such a different experience hearing the author, the poet, read the poem. There's different places of emphasis and flow and stuff like that. And it's really, really interesting. That's an amazing long form. Have you ever thought about just giving up the short form? Because it's obvious you really like the long form.
I really like the long form, you know. I think about it all the time. Just the heck with it, you know. Just keep writing one long.
How long was the Monarch poem? Like, was it many pages?
Oh, it was a whole book. It was a whole book called The Monarchs. And I think it was 60 or 62 poems. And yeah, it was great. They weren't all about monarch butterflies, but you know, it ended up. Oh, it was a book that was. It was 60 poems. It was.
Wow.
A little book, 74 pages long, but it also had all kinds of weird science stuff in it, sci-fi. And it also had, because I was so interested in the monarch butterfly's migration, it sent me on a journey looking into the evolution of intelligence across the span of nature. And so there are lots of poems about intelligence in the book as well.
I have to say this. One of the things that I loved about your poetry is its contact with science and biology and natural history. Because it's, you know, everybody keeps those areas separate, poetry on one side and the science on the other. And it's so refreshing to just read poets who are versed in science.
Well, I love hearing you say that because it is one of my central interests. And, I grew up in a pretty literary family. We had lots of storybooks and poetry books, but I also had science books. I had a children's natural history encyclopedia. I had little guidebooks to trees and flowers and birds. And
the Golden Guides?
Yeah.
I still have mine from when I was a kid.
Oh, that's great.
Those are the things that inspired young people.
Yeah, they do. They inspire young people to pay attention to the world. And so for me as a child, you know, books, art and science, there was no difference. They were all
books,
and they were all great, and they took me out into the world, and that was wonderful. And I'm never really left that. I mean, I feel science is where a lot of my inspiration comes from. In fact, my next nonfiction book, I'm going to try to dig a little bit more into this art-science thing and see where that takes me.
We're all out of time. My returning guest tonight is nonfiction writer and poet Allison Hawthorne Deming, professor in creative writing at the University of Arizona. She lives in Tucson, Arizona, in the Grand Manan Island in New Brunswick, Canada. And we've been talking about her poetry collection. It's really wonderful. Stairway to Heaven. Allison, it's been a pleasure talking.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.